Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, it's hard to think of a time when a free press is more necessary than when the public needs to know about crimes committed in our name. So the release of a Senate report on CIA torture is a test for U.S. media. We'll talk about the report and the media response with Bahar Azmi, legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Also this week, Ashton Carter will likely be the next Secretary of Defense. Press coverage tells us he's a Rhodes Scholar, a physicist, and an Uber wonk. But what else should we know about him? And what does his selection mean for U.S. military policy? Author and military analyst Mel Goodman will join us to discuss that. All that's coming up, but first, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
In the wake of horrific revelations about the CIA's torture of terrorism suspects, many of whom turned out to have no ties at all to militant groups, ABC World News made a decision not to consider how such nightmarish things came to happen and how we can make certain they'll never happen again, but to fearmonger that the release of the information might lead to violence against Americans. On alert, will report put Americans in danger, was the graphic, while Martha Raddatz told viewers that the report includes some details never heard before and many people fearing tonight that revealing them will lead to violence. Well, there's no question about who she means. Raddatz spelled it out, quote, "The Muslim world has erupted many times before when the U.S. and the West have been accused of religious and cultural slights," close quote. The report describes detainees being forced to stand on broken legs, deprived of sleep for up to 180 hours, or having CIA agents threaten to sexually abuse their mothers. Are these the sorts of slights she means? Naturally, the segment can't end without the claim that, quote, "if this report is released, groups like ISIS will take full advantage," close quote. Turning the U.S. into the potential victim of the story, of the U.S.'s actual crimes, is nothing short of perverse. And U.S. citizens are hardly served by a press corps so eager to close the book on CIA torture that some aren't even willing to open it.
The story continued of questions surrounding a Rolling Stone investigation into sexual assaults on college campuses, and one particular case at the University of Virginia, a controversy we spoke about last week. Rolling Stone is stepping away from the flawed report, leaving many concerned that the larger issue of campus rape and rape culture is getting not just obscured, but undermined. A chance to disparage a feminist cause is an unfortunate draw for corporate media's attention. ABC's This Week was one outlet weighing in, bringing Rich Lowry of the right-wing National Review to offer a lesson in media accountability.
Well, when something is so explosive, you have to be certain it's right. And Rolling Stone didn't do basic fact-checking here. I believe because they had an agenda to portray UVA as this bastion of white male privilege where basically rapists rule the social life, and the damage will never be undone.
Fact-checking is important, and bad journalism does do damage. There's no arguing with that. But it's a bit much coming from Lowry, who, among other things, was one of the loudest advocates for the Iraq War, based on the supposed links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. As he put it on CBS right before the invasion, quote, "There is a connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda. There is no division in the U.S. government about this anymore. Everyone agrees there's 10 years' worth of contacts between Iraq and al-Qaeda," close quote. Well, that claim was false, of course, and people knew it at the time. One wonders if Lowry thinks about the resulting damage that can't be undone. But then why would he? Unlike Rolling Stone, Lowry faced no special harm to his pundit career for being so careless with the facts. You might even call that a privilege.
We're already seeing some 2016 campaign journalism. That might be bad enough, but what's worse is when the reporting is about an important issue, or should be, at least. Take the December 5th piece in the New York Times about Chris Christie's trip to Canada to promote the Keystone XL pipeline. He gave it a bear-hugging embrace, the paper says, adding that Keystone has united the Republican Party. The story is all about how wise it is for Christie to stake out this ground. He's making corporate donors happy, as well as the party's grassroots base. The Times also notes that Christie isn't going to debate this. Quote, Mr. Christie seemed disinclined to hear from opponents, speaking only to a corporate crowd heavily invested in the project's approval. Close quote. Well, the same could be said for the New York Times. The paper tells us Keystone is the most contested cross-border energy project in a generation, but it quotes no Keystone critics who might have something to say about climate change or deforestation, or could challenge Christie's rhetoric about so-called energy independence. That's because journalism like this doesn't actually try to focus on the very important issues under discussion. It's mostly concerned with what a politician's rhetoric reveals about his possible strategy for a campaign that doesn't yet exist.
In the quaint notions about journalism department, many would think there was something wrong with an investigative reporter who consults directly with an advertiser to think of ways for them to profit from the news. But here we are. Media blogger Jim Romanesco reported on an ad placed by the Cincinnati Inquirer for an investigative reporter. But not just any reporter. Candidates needed to know that 50% of their focus would be readers aged 25 to 45, and that they would be working with, quote, an advertising partner to grow and monetize the 25 to 45 audience, close quote. Romanesco asked Inquirer editor Carolyn Washburn to explain how that whole monetizing thing would work. Her response was not reassuring. That expectation was part of all beat job descriptions, she said. Sales reps and reporters can share insights and make introductions for each other that may be helpful. But wait a minute, aren't some of those advertisers also potential sources? Well, why yes. Quote, many of those organizations are both advertisers and sources, and many of those organizations are trying to grow their reach among 25 to 45-year-olds in the community, just as we are, close quote. By the time Washburn says that reporters' profit-driven collaboration with advertisers, who are also sources, doesn't hurt the newsroom or readers at all, you might be wondering if she's ever even heard of conflict of interest. But she assures she can fathom circumstances in which she'd say no to a sponsor request, and reporters are told to raise questions if they are ever uncomfortable or uncertain. Well, it's not their ability to ask questions that troubles us. It's what the answers seem likely to be.
And finally, while the coverage is certainly not without its problems, it's been encouraging to see media outlets devoting serious time to discussing police brutality and racism on major platforms like the Sunday chat shows. There was one exception, though. On the December 7th edition of Fox News Sunday, Chris Wallace turned to far-right radio host Rush Limbaugh to discuss race relations. Yes, that Rush Limbaugh, the guy who once quipped that composite pictures of wanted criminals resemble Jesse Jackson, and that the NAACP, quote, should have riot rehearsal, they should get a liquor store and practice robberies, close quote. He's also the guy who lost a TV sports gig for claiming that the rest of the media was cheering on a quarterback just because he was black. On top of all that, Rush Limbaugh has a long record of getting things wrong. He kept that up in the Fox appearance, claiming that Attorney General Eric Holder had called the New York Police Department an occupying force. Holder didn't say that. He gave a speech about Ferguson that talked about the need for better relations between a community and its police force, so that such forces would not be seen as an occupying force disconnected from the communities they serve. Wallace, a Fox host with a reputation for not being as bad as some of the other Fox hosts, let Limbaugh slide. He did acknowledge that the two were friends, and he closed the interview hoping he would get Limbaugh back on the show again soon. That says all you need to know about Chris Wallace.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. A report by the Senate Intelligence Committee on the CIA's secret interrogations of suspects of terrorism renders what the Washington Post described as a strikingly bleak verdict on the post-September 11th program. The report not only details the use of torture, forcing people with broken legs to stand for hours, up to 180 hours of sleep deprivation, stuffing people into coffin-sized boxes, sexual assaults, and more. It also concludes that this torture did not provide any intelligence that could not have been or had not already been provided through other methods, and that the CIA lied about the program, about how many people had been waterboarded, for example, or whether interrogations were recorded, among other things. So what now? Are we to understand this report as closing the book on these horrific actions undertaken in our name? Here to discuss this is Bahir Azmi, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Bahir Azmi.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the report doesn't call for a further investigation or offer any recommendations, really. There's this sense that it's just a sort of memo to file, a note for the record, not intended to prompt any action. And yet, as Dianne Feinstein and others contend, it's meant to ensure that this never happens again. How would it do that? Are we to believe that just seeing it written down would somehow shame the CIA from doing anything like it again? I don't really get it.
Yeah, I don't entirely get it either. And one thing to note is, of course, this is just the executive summary. There is an underlying 6,000-page report that, as shocking as the executive summary is, probably contains even more detail and comprehensiveness about the scope of this torture program. And the report only deals with CIA black sites, not Guantanamo, Bagram, etc. So certainly disclosure and transparency and sort of owning up to patently illegal conduct is important. But given the consistently recurring rogue practices of the CIA, it's not enough. Unless we have meaningful accountability, which in our view at the Center for Constitutional Rights includes domestic criminal prosecution, there is no way to set the norm here around the illegality without that kind of meaningful consequence.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the implication of Obama, because he's come forward and said that this investigation of what he calls a troubling program reinforces his view that these harsh methods, and I would note that neither the Senate nor the Washington Post, for that matter, use the word torture, that these are inconsistent with our values as a nation and so on. It makes it appear that it's entirely a matter of the previous administration, and I wonder to what extent you see the Obama White House implicated for their own actions or inactions.
Well, I mean, I think they're implicated insofar as they're not ensuring that crimes are punished and they are tacitly accepting that this was just routine mistake in the course of patriotic behavior. To Obama's credit, one of the first things he did on his first day in office was to order the closing of the CIA black sites in which so many of these gruesome practices occurred, and B, to end any authorization for the use of these kinds of torture techniques. But when you're dealing with a covert agency like the CIA, which is functionally, practically accountable to nobody and never has been, it's entirely possible that there are still, if not a sort of formal orchestrated torture program, as in the Bush administration, there may still be violations in the breach.
Well, the U.S. is signatory to the UN's Convention Against Torture. What role does or should that play here?
That's a really important point, because the Convention Against Torture, which the first President Bush signed, not only prohibits the use of torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment should there be ambiguity about technical definitions of torture, in all circumstances, regardless of exigency. Mindful that all torturing parties claim exigency, make clear that that is not an excuse. In addition to that prohibition, all signatories have accepted an ironclad obligation to prosecute individuals who have committed torture. And so under international law, the U.S. is simply not entitled to wink and say, sorry, we tortured some folks. There have to be credible criminal investigations and bona fide prosecutions in order to be within our international law commitments, as we would expect any other torturing country to do who we so routinely criticize.
There's a piece in Foreign Policy that includes this passage, quote, shocked by an attack that revealed vulnerabilities we had long ignored, the nation reeled and then made the avoidance of another such attack the primary organizing principle of our national security policy. From then on, it was down the slippery slope to the point where we have allowed ourselves to believe that essentially anyone, anywhere can be a threat. This, in turn, justified the use of any means possible against anyone, anywhere, close quote. Well, statements like that about what the nation did and what we allowed ourselves to believe, they're so frustrating to those of us who never, on any level, justified the use of any means possible, who actually fought this mindset and these actions from the beginning. If this is supposed to, you know, speak to history, it seems very wrong and harmful to depict the country as being of one mind on these issues, even in what are being called the dark days post-September 11th.
Yeah, that too is a really important point. I mean, I think the torture apologists are trying to suggest that the capital we, that is the entire polity, demanded this of our government officials, which is preposterous. The entire we, through the Senate, ratified the Convention Against Torture and the War Crimes Statute and made our commitments against torture very clear. What this is a criminal conspiracy by government officials and contractors to subvert those legal principles, cover them up, and lie about them. And I, too, am shocked and frustrated that people want to suggest that the historical lesson is a collective mistake. And that's why prosecutions are important. They have a norming function to say this is outlying behavior. We, the public, have determined that this is incorrect, and the mechanism that we use in our country, imperfect as it often is, to isolate illegal and immoral behavior is criminal prosecution. Unless we do that, a potential historical lesson would be sort of global ratification of this horrific illegality.
Well, finally, the Sunday chat shows gave Republicans and people including Michael Hayden, former CIA director, a chance to dismiss and rebut, their word, the report before it even came out. ABC News delivered a flabbergasting report focused entirely on the notion that the release of the report will lead to violence and threaten American lives. There's a stark unwillingness on the part of many journalists to accept that what was done, and by us, if you will. Do you have any thoughts about what you would hope to see from news media going forward?
I would hope for a lot better than what we've gotten around the description of these techniques for a long time. I think it wasn't until last year that the New York Times used the term torture with respect to U.S. practices, even as they identified identical practices used by foreign governments as torture. And the media should express some meaningful expectation and skepticism around the sort of reactionary defense of this stuff by the torture apologists. They need to be educated about the legal proscriptions and sort of get out of the exhausting beltway mentality that this is a one side versus the other. Torture is like genocide to the use of chemical weapons, absolutely prohibited, and there can be no justifications. So need to get out of that Republican, Democrat, left, right, up, down mentality that the media is so obsessed with.
We've been speaking with Bahir Azmi of the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can find them online at ccrjustice.org. Thank you very much, Bahir Azmi, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The sudden departure of Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel shocked, but perhaps did not surprise, elite media and Beltway insiders. Just days later came the news that Ashton Carter would be nominated to take his place. Carter has won praise across the political spectrum. He's a physicist who studied medieval history, who just so happens to be an expert in Pentagon budgets. But who is Ashton Carter, and what does his nomination suggest about national security policy? Joining us now to talk about that is Mel Goodman. He is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. His most recent book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. Welcome back to Counterspin, Mel Goodman.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be with you.
So here's what we know from reading some of the coverage of Carter. He's studied medieval history and physics. As one ABC report put it, Carter knows budgets, bombs, and the building, meaning the Pentagon. An LA Times headline, Pentagon insider technocrat with love of physics. It's not that any of that is false, but what is more important, perhaps, to know about Ashton Carter and his history?
Well, what I find important about Ashton Carter, he's this kind of breed of cat that they call defense intellectual. I'm not sure what that term defense intellectual means, but it's been applied to people who I find leave the academic community or the think tank community or the academy at one level or another, come to Washington and harden their views. And I'll give you a very good example of that. In the 1980s, when he was at the Kennedy School, he did a very important piece for the Office of Technology Assessment, very critical of Star Wars, of Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. And he made a very compelling argument about national missile defense, that it's not workable, it's very expensive, it's counterproductive, it could harm arms control. Then he joins the Clinton administration in the 1990s as an official in the Defense Department, and Clinton was finally persuaded to move in the direction of national missile defense. He took modest steps, but he did it for political reasons, domestic reasons. But Carter wrote a lot of pieces for the administration, making the case for national missile defense, a total reversal. And then with the Obama administration, when he was the deputy defense secretary, he took strong positions in favor of regional missile defense in Eastern Europe. In other words, we would put radars and associated missiles in Poland and the Czech Republic, and this would guard against a missile threat from Iran, which, of course, makes no sense whatsoever. That's pure science fiction fantasy. But this reversal, this complete change of opinion, I think is typical of what happens to the so-called defense intellectuals when they come to Washington. My other concern with him is a willingness or even a proclivity to recommend force as an instant reaction to issues. And he did this in the case of North Korea on a couple of occasions. Again, in the 1990s, when the Clinton administration was debating what to do about the North Korean nuclear program, it was Carter who wrote a memo advocating a military strike on their nuclear facilities. And fortunately, Clinton was persuaded to move in another direction, a diplomatic direction, which is not used enough. And out of that came the agreed framework, which led to a freeze on North Korea's nuclear program for nearly a decade until George Bush came along in 2001 and really compromised that agreement. Also, I think when I've seen his writings, as recently as last year, by the way, when he talks about defense spending on strategic missiles, and he's always argued that this is a very small part of the defense budget, and there are real savings that could be had in arms control and limiting strategic forces. That's just not true. A lot of the spending on strategic missiles is not in the defense budget per se. It's in the Department of Energy. So when you add what the Department of Energy spends to what the Pentagon spends on strategic missiles, and the work I've done, particularly in national insecurity, the cost of American militarism, that's almost a quarter of our defense spending over the last 40 or 50 years. So there's tremendous savings in arms control. And then finally, and I hope this issue comes up in the hearings that will begin in January or early February, Carter's role in pushing the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, which even Senator John McCain, who of course will chair those confirmation hearings for the Armed Forces Committee, he's referred to that program as a train wreck and said he got sticker shock when he saw some of the projected costs of the F-35.
You do get the sense that he's more hawkish than Hagel. There was a New York Times report with a line that said that this would likely mean a stronger use of American power overseas. Of course, when Hagel took the job, there was this idea that part of his role would be to manage the reduction in defense spending and the Pentagon budget, and he seemed like someone who was well suited for that. Is that moment just over now, do you think?
Well, I think that moment has clearly passed. And I think there's been a certain amount of unfairness with regard to Hegel. He was signed on at a time when there was sequestration, that you had to cut the defense bill. The Congress had mandated cuts in defense spending. We wanted to get out of Iraq and reduce significantly our presence in Afghanistan. Hegel was never one of these moralists in foreign policy. He didn't talk about exceptionalism and triumphalism and the indispensable nation. And I think this is what Obama wanted. He had a close relationship in the Senate with Hegel. I mean, he wasn't in the Senate very long, but the two of them traveled together and seemed to have similar attitudes about national security strategy and national military strategy.
Now, a lot of the discussion about these things focuses on the personalities. Hegel wasn't on the inside with White House officials. He was too quiet at meetings. Carter, they say, isn't going to be like that at all. You even hear complaints about Obama or other folks at the White House being too micromanaging of the Pentagon. It all sounds a little bit gossipy, and for those of us who don't work at the Pentagon, we might wonder whether it all matters. But I wanted to ask you, do you think this has real policy implications when you hear about this, when you hear either about the treatment of Hegel or the expected behavior of Carter? Does it mean something?
Well, I think it does mean something. If you read Gates's memoir, he hit the Obama administration very hard on this. Leon Panetta did the same thing in his memoir. Hegel certainly said it on the way out, and Senator McCain backed him up on that issue. My problem with the charge is every administration has micromanaged sensitive foreign policy issues. You know, look at Nixon and Kissinger and the secrecy within the government on these issues. What I think is different with this particular administration is the lack of expertise within the White House. So it's micromanaging by people who really have no expertise, who are hard to take seriously on issues of major substance. And I think the problem really, ultimately, you have to point to the president, Barack Obama, who has made very poor appointments in the national security field. So I think Carter was probably the best that could be done at this particular time. But as I said earlier, don't expect any great changes.
We've been speaking with Mel Goodman. His most recent book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. You can read his piece, The Military-Industrial Complex Gets Its Man, at counterpunch.org. Mel Goodman, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be with you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.